You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU Burnaby.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and I'm joined today by Hale, my co-host. So we're going to be doing something a little bit differently than what we've been doing in the past, or at least for the last little while, discussing articles or essays and bringing them in to a kind of larger thematic conversation. Today, we're going to look at some actual text on show. The texts that we're going to be looking at are the pre-Socratics. And I guess the reason we're doing this is more or less that, Hale, you brought to my attention that you got a collection of pre-Socratics fragments, and you said, hey, these look interesting. Why don't we look at these? And I think that's a great idea, and I think that doing readings on the show actually is it's a great opportunity. So I was curious... just as far as what interested you in bringing these to the show.
The pre-Socratics were definitely thinkers who popped up somewhat frequently in discussions, especially on ancient philosophy, and as well a lot of times in certain realms of existentialism and phenomenology, some more modern stuff like that. I think, though, that why I come back there or come back to them on sometimes or find them interesting is... frankly, they are a bit mysterious. They're definitely a bit cryptic. It's definitely the birth of what we would more consistently call philosophy. Like, as our listeners will probably note today, some of what you'll hear, what we're reading, it doesn't really... like, we're clearly not reading Aristotle or Sartre. We're not reading long-form, descriptive... prose, you know, that go, you know, are very technical and go into minutia. There's a lot of kind of very cryptic, almost sometimes mystical type language. But at the same time, it's very clearly an era where people start really critically thinking about, like, how, what we are, how the world is, and what, you know, and also fundamentally, like, what being is. Like, it's, you know, put another way, you know, fundamental questions of existence and metaphysics and all that kind of stuff are things that really start to pop up with the pre-Socratics. And they have some interesting and often kind of eclectic things to say about that stuff. But it's also, I think, just more on a base level, people really, it's some of our earliest recordings of people actually considering these philosophical questions. And transitioning to that critical and almost at times more scientific mindset, and wanting to really understand, like, the world that they live in and themselves, and doing so not just holding to whatever religious or mystical traditions they were, you know, surrounded by. Obviously, those things kind of seep in, that's clear. But these were people, as our listeners will hear, these were people who were very clearly trying to understand the world as it is or as they were experiencing it, at the very least.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great reason. Those are great reasons to be interested in the pre-Socratics. For me, it's interesting because I find that when I actually, and we'll get to reading them, and I'll bring these up when we are reading specifically the Aristotle and the Theophrastus fragments, but the thing that's interesting for me is that the reach that you have to make to really grasp what a pre-Socratic thinker like Thales or Heraclitus is talking about, if what they're saying is kind of being reported, so we don't have so today we're going to be talking about three thinkers in particular. They're usually called the Meletians. Of these three, we don't have any fragments. We don't have any quotations from them, except Anaximander. Like, maybe it might be a quote. It probably is, but all of these thinkers that we're going to be talking about today, there is an interesting kind of philological exercise you have to do to get beneath what is written there, to get to the kernel of, well, what is the thought here actually? Because when you read the Aristotle's got a lot of intellectual baggage kind of going into what he is saying. So even independent of what their doctrines are or what their ideas were, it's like intellectual or conceptual archaeology in a way, where you have to dust away the dirt to get to the idea. And in that, there is a special opportunity for a kind of critical reading that you get to do with the pre-Socratic. So even independent of the content or what they think, you're thinking these are ancient thoughts. Like, these are even 100, 200 years even before Aristotle. These are quite buried ideas, and you even have to get underneath the ideas that are transmitting them. So that's quite fun.
Yeah, and just so to our listeners have a better idea, it's, I think a lot of what you're talking about here, Brandon, is that like, when you say we don't have any direct quotes, like, there's no surviving texts from any of the people we're going to be talking about today. I don't think any of the pre-Socratics have any direct surviving texts, other than kind of Parmenides, like someone fully quoted his work or extensively that survived.
So yes, Parmenides, we have significant portions of his poem from. We can safely attribute quite a number of quotations to Heraclitus. Even that Anaximander quote with Theophrastus, which we'll get to today, I imagine is a quotation for the reason that when Theophrastus quotes it, he says, Anaximander said that when he said this, it was quite poetic. So Theophrastus seems to be maintaining the exact words and trying to get across that poetic form, which is what makes me think that it is actually a quotation.
But yes, but we are dealing a lot with basically either other writers, many of whom were ancient themselves. So it's not like we're, you know, we got to remember that, like, yeah, we're dealing with quotations, we're dealing with basically commentary, but this is like 2,000-year-old commentary. It's just what happened to survive, or it's commentary through commentary through commentary, right? And so, just like Brandon's kind of, you're saying, like, we know these were real thinkers. We have bits and pieces of them, but it's like they're kind of frozen. Those bits and pieces are kind of frozen in an amber of other thought and stuff that's come after that. You kind of have to sort of melt away and get to figure out, okay, like, what was someone like Thales? Like, what were they actually thinking about? What was Heraclitus actually concerned with? And what is a misquote, reinterpretation, someone being kind of manipulative to their own ends, to use this past thinkers' ideas to prop up their own stuff at their own time, right? So there is that whole aspect for our listeners of, like, trying to get through to the pre-Socratics. Not only are their ideas often kind of cryptic and oftentimes kind of a little bit mystical, the sort of academic style that you see, well, the super accessible, almost pseudo-dramatic style that you see in Plato, and the super academic style that you see in someone more like Aristotle, just is not there. So you're dealing with that formatting issue, but then also too, you're dealing with the issue of trying to figure out, like, what pieces really were Thales or Heraclitus and what were not. Today we're going to be covering the three of the earliest pre-Socratics. These are the early guys. These are the super OGs of philosophy. They're called the Milesians. Who are the Milesians, and why is that, like, so significant for the kind of the origins of Western philosophy?
Yeah, it's a great question. So they're called the Milesians. It's a demonym, which means that they're Milesians because they come from a town off sort of the mid to a little bit south of the border, or along the coast of the Ionian coast, which is now the modern day west shore of Turkey. So if you know the Ionian Sea, it'll be on the east shore of that. Along that shore is various cities that are going to be very important for the kind of birth of Greek or Western philosophy, some indirectly. When we talk about the Eleatics, like Parmenides and Pythagoras, we'll be talking about Magna Graeca, which is in the West. So that's on the Italian peninsula and Sicily and whatnot. But right now we're talking about Miletus, which is on that Ionian coast. Miletus is an interesting town for a couple reasons. One is that Miletus was a port town. This town is not just a port town. The Greeks are quite, they were quite proficient shipbuilders and captains and navigators. So they traveled throughout the whole world along this this sort of mode of transportation, but it was also significantly accessible by road in the east. So there was a significant amount of cultural traffic in Miletus in terms of trade and whatnot. It's imaginable that it was an intellectual hub for the time. It's not so much an intellectual hub in the sense that, you know, there are schools or anything like that. What is interesting about Miletus as well is that it is one of the most, or it was a very successful tyrant city. So at the time, tyrants were the people who would have risen up against the classical period's decaying and quite easily toppled over system of monarchs and whatnot. So if you look at very, very ancient archaeological sites in Greece, many of them are palaces, and these palaces are, they house monarchs, they have kings who are gathering an enormous amount of wealth and resources. This is reflected in the literature of Homer. So if you read Homer and you read like the Odyssey, where he encounters the Achaeans, or the Phaeacians, sorry, Odysseus encounters the Phaeacians and he goes into their palace. That is the picture of the old world. Philosophy is the new world, where tyrants rose up against these, seized these old palaces, and essentially redistributed the resources to the people who backed these tyrants. So it wasn't democratic in the sense that, okay, well, people elected these tyrants to go do something, but you absolutely had much more involvement because you had people who had power and support for backing these people. So what happened here is that you had a lot of, not rich, but you had affluent people who were engaged in mercantile trade and who could traffic in ideas and languages along other places. And Miletus, like, this is happening in various places, but Miletus seemed to be one of the more successful cities. And so it's no wonder that philosophy would begin here, especially too because this is one of the places where laws are being discussed among these citizens. And in order for citizens to have discussions of this kind, you have to be able to make arguments and you have to be able to make appeals, impartial appeals to your citizens and to your fellow citizens. And that wasn't necessary in the old Homeric world where kings doled out laws. There was no large-scale discussion of these things. There was the transmission of stories and whatnot. And that kind of, if you've encountered any of the literature in pre-Socratic philosophy, you may have encountered this idea of a transition from a muthos to a logos. I think it's a plausible framing. I don't think it's the most interesting way to read the pre-Socratics, and I think it might be good for going into them, but if you want to like really close read stuff, then it gets complicated and it doesn't really answer all of your questions once you want to actually like read Thales or something like that. But I bring it up because there would have been a transmission of laws, but now the laws are being discussed by impartial citizens who have mercantile interests, and it wouldn't surprise us if they began doing that for more than just their laws, if they began asking questions not about how do the laws work or how should they work for us, but how does the world work? How does the universe work? What composes the universe? What laws are they regulated by, just as we're regulated by laws? So that's essentially the preface that I can give for Miletus. I can't answer why did it happen specifically in Miletus and not in other trade cities, but this is as plausible as a window as I can give. It was a successful and quite diverse Ionian city.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you did an excellent job, by the way, of describing that for our listeners. I'm sure a lot of people got a good picture of, you know, of an era and world that is really not well known to many. I think, though, that although much more simplistic than your description, one useful thing to think about is the actual location of Asia Minor, of Turkey, of the Milesian coast there. You know, in that it also in the old world, we're talking the very ancient world for our listeners, that it sits kind of in a really central point. You know, much later on in history, but it still gives some idea, you know, in the Middle Ages and such like that, the world would often be drawn as a map with Jerusalem in the center. And, you know, the Milesian coast is actually not, it within the context of that map, that known world, that ancient world, the Milesian coast is also quite close to the center, right? So you have to the west, you have classic Greece, you've got Italy, you've got North Africa, which at the time had many quite advanced and very active civilizations. And then to the east, you've got major cultures in the Fertile Crescent, which are some of the real origins of modern civilization, of writing, of thought, going all the way down to India, which was also very active philosophically and scientifically speaking at the time. So it really did, I think you described it much better, but for our listeners, you really have to imagine this is a central travel, trade, and exchange point. So it does, on some level, the fact that people really started encountering new ideas, thinking about things, especially with all the political transition that was going on at the time, where you basically had a lot of people entering into positions of power and authority that may have an influence that may have otherwise been isolated, really caused people to start to think a lot more about basically what's going on. And one of the fundamental aspects of how that started to look is, you know, that appeal to reason, basically. And that's a simplified version, but as you were kind of mentioning, moving away from just closed societies, basically saying the world is the way it is because of X pseudo religious ritualistic perspective, and instead trying to justify why I think things are such and such a way or should be such and such a way. And I have to be able to convey that to people, especially people who might not come from my specific clan, family, group, town that is generally very isolated. I'm now having to interact on a much larger scale, on a broader scale, on a more diverse scale. How do I communicate that? How do I get people to understand why I think the way I do?
That's interesting.
And that's that appeal to reason.
I hadn't considered that possibility, the emergence of philosophy as a kind of intercultural capacity to explain things. That's really interesting, because you're right. And as we go into Thales, we'll find that Thales was quite, he took up a lot of information from various sources. So at least the Babylonians and the Egyptians, but also the Phoenicians. So he comes from, or he was educated and understood that various cultures had various ideas about the way that things were construed, and philosophy as an answer to either trying to reconcile or even to make communication between these possible. I think that's a rich suggestion.
This whole period, especially from kind of 5000 BC on and into, you know, the area that we're going to talk about now, was an area which in the context of human development was seeing quite rapid change. Agricultural societies, you know, the idea of towns and urban areas was all relatively young at the beginning of this period. People had lived in a more or less hunter-gatherer, very small community, very small population type societies, which from at least from what we know, again, this is outside of just a brief outside of that, but at least from anthropological and archaeological study, were remarkably consistent for tens of thousands of years. And then we enter into a period where things really start to set, people start to settle, people start to farm, things start to shift. And obviously, we like we were talking about earlier with the Fertile Crescent and the Sumerians and all these types of people, where you start to get things like writing and government systems and bureaucracies and all this kind of stuff. And so it's very interesting to see the pre-Socratics as part of that humanistic conversation, right? Of as we begin to sort of like branch out, as things become basically society and human beings, for that matter, become more and more complex, of course we start to reflect and think like, basically, why is the world the way it is? Like, why is it that way? So yeah, so we're really seeing human development come on at a rate that it didn't happen before or was not consistent at all. And I really think that in some ways we're seeing the pre-Socratics as a major component of that process, right? Of starting to think philosophically, of starting to think scientifically of ourselves and the world around us, right? And I think that's, to come back to your old question, I know we've been kind of doing this intro for our listeners for a little bit, but it is really interesting to think about, like, who were these people and why do we care? That is a big part of why we should care about the pre-Socratics, is they're some of the first people that we at least have some kind of recording of, who really wanted to get to the bottom of being a human being, right? Of being a human being, of existence, of why things are the way they are. And that's a really interesting and impactful goal. And the methodology that they used was revolutionary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the kinds of it's, so this is one of the things that I do find appealing about, to go to the, back to this idea of a mythos versus a logos. It's this idea that, and I don't borrow too much from it, but one of the interesting ideas is that the kinds of questions that the pre-Socratics are asking are radically new, right? So we can, if you want to dive in, I can explain what I mean, but yeah, so let's turn to some actual text. Let's get started with this. I'm reading from your particular edition. We have two different editions at the moment, but that's okay. So I'm on page 7. So he, Thales, said that the world is... Yeah, so this is quoting Seneca. He, Thales, said that the world is held up by water and rides like a ship, and when it is said to quake, it is actually rocking because of the water's movement. I think the interesting... So to bring up this idea that we can explain a quake or an earthquake using some kind of natural or naturalistic mechanism like this, just very quickly to address this idea of a mythos versus a logos in this sense. If you wanted to explain, if you were, okay, you're a Greek and you want to explain why an earthquake happened, why, what would you do? What would you, how would you explain that?
So my initial step to try and get my mind in the mindset of a Greek, obviously it's very ancient Greek, not a modern Greek.
Yeah.
But that obviously is very difficult, but my initial jump where my head goes is to talk to something pseudo-religious, god-oriented, right? Like, why, I live in a world that's got a pantheon of gods. They're all powerful, at least from my understanding. They more or less run the world. If the world is shaking, like literally the whole world is shaking, they must be involved.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. So what you would do is, if the world is shaking, you would say, what's going on with Poseidon? Poseidon is upset, or Poseidon's will is being enacted in some way, right? Now, what's really interesting about this response is you can inquire further, right? The mythological way of explaining the world does give you a framework for approaching these kinds of questions, right? Because here's an earthquake. Poseidon is enacting his will. You can ask, well, why did Poseidon enact his will here? What is going on? So, and if you want to answer that, you would need to know something about the Olympian drama and stuff that goes on with the gods. But it's really interesting here in this particular case. So I'll read it again. He, Thales, said that the world is held up by water and rides like a ship. And when it is said to quake, it is actually rocking because of the water's movement. What's really important about the kinds of questions and answers that the pre-Socratics are asking is that the further particular why of, okay, well, Poseidon is shaking the earth, but why is Poseidon shaking the earth? With a naturalistic answer, you can't ask that question. So you have a naturalistic explanation for why the earth is shaking. The earth rests on top of water and the water is shaking. You might ask, okay, well, what is shaking the water? But that's not the same thing as explaining why is the earth shaking right now. It's not motivated. It's not preceded by any kind. It has a preceding cause, but it doesn't have a preceding event or story behind it. With Thales, you have generalized answers to natural phenomena, whereas with the mythological answers to these, you have particular answers. Why this earthquake? Why did Poseidon get upset this time? Whereas with Thales, there is no this time. Now, earthquakes are highly general natural phenomena.
This is not an appeal to any kind of god. It's not an appeal to religion. It's not an appeal to mythology. It might sound pretty absurd to us now, but it's the kind of explanation that in theory could be given to anyone to accept, right? Because let's say, you know, if I'm an ancient Greek and there's an earthquake and I'm with my friend who, say, is a Sumerian, or perhaps they're an ancient Jew would be another great one, and I say, well, Poseidon is angry, clearly, blah, 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 blah. Their simple response is, Poseidon's not real. It's obviously Yahweh or like the hawk god or whatever, right? Like, and so that there's that again, there's that exchange isn't there. When you're giving these more naturalistic, these what we might call early scientific reasonings, the idea again is that like I'm appealing to reason. I look around, it looks like the world is surrounded by water. It looks like it's, you know, it's got edges on either end. You know, when I put a ship in the water, it bobs around and it moves and it shakes. And we're sitting on what perhaps could be kind of like a ship of land floating in the water. Why wouldn't it bob and shake and move as well? It's a reasoned explanation.
Yeah, you're using a kind of analogical reasoning to explain a natural phenomenon in that sense. Yeah.
So with that, should we... For our list, is there anything that you want to say personally about Thales, since he's the first guy we're going to talk about?
Yeah, do you want me to, I guess, give a picture of what Thales is
about? Yeah, let's give a very brief picture of Thales, and then we can read a few more of his, well-known fragments.
Yeah, so in today's image, essentially he's the water guy.
Right? He's waterman. He's Squirtle of philosophy. Yeah. He's a waterbender.
So he's actually a great way into explaining the Milesians in general, but essentially the picture that we have of Thales of Miletus is that he is a thinker who took a single principle or a single substance as the arche or the beginning or the principle of reality. And he decided or concluded from, you can probably tell what it is from the first fragment that I cited, all things are water. We can get into this. I personally don't think that Thales thought that rocks were water, but I do think that he did think that you can give an intelligible explanation of the world with reference to water. I mean, rocks take shape because of the water that they're rained on, and there's erosion from mountains and whatnot, and you can account for all kinds of things with water. So to say that the principle, not necessarily the substance, but the principle, the arche, that which begins the world is water, is essentially that's what Thales is especially known for. There's a couple other anecdotes in the fragments as well.
Thales is perhaps the first recorded thinker who really introduces three fundamental aspects of philosophy, particularly the study of metaphysics, particularly the study of what we might call ontology, the study of being. He's looking for one fundamental